Okay. Let me tell you what's going to happen tonight. I'm going to blab. The first session, I have about 75 minutes of stuff. And I looked for an easier way out. I really did. But there are some things that just kept coming at me in this last few weeks that I had to approach and I had to write. So the first 75 minutes, I'm just going to blab. And then the second half, I have stuff. If you have nothing to say, I've got stuff. Believe me, I got stuff. But I'd like to maybe then open it up and talk a bit more about some of the first half. Okay? So give me 75 and a half minutes, more or less. More. Hell. Hell no. Hell yes. We need to talk some more about hell. In spontaneous comments I made in our last session, I confess that doing this series of lectures has been hell. And I suspect that you thought I was talking figuratively. But I wasn't. I was talking literally. In Liber Novus, Jung took a journey to hell. And I found myself in the darkness of this last winter there with him. In several prior readings of Liber Novus, I had really not followed him into that depth. And though in my hubris I thought I understood the book and Jung's experience, I really had not. I had not gone far enough. Yes, I heard him recount his experience, but I had not followed him. And thus, I really did not fully understand. And I probably yet do not. And I do not suspect that many of you did either. It's not easy. And that type of understanding will probably not come with a first or second or third reading of Liber Novus. But I must confess, something happened to me during this last reading, this last winter. And I came away from our meeting last time, 2 months ago, quite shaken. And very certain that those sections of Liber Novus that I had been reading and attempting to share with you were a key to understanding Carl Gustav Jung. They are the profound fact at foundation, at center of his experience. Over the last 2 months, I've not been able to escape that experience of hell. Hell just kept coming at me, no matter how I tried to turn away. A friend here in our seminar came over to talk to me. I enjoy that. And it so happens that he's taking a course at the university that he finds very interesting. It's taught by Margaret Toscano, a distinguished professor of language and literature at the university, who I suspect some of you know. The subject of the course? Hell. He wanted to talk to me about hell. A couple weeks after our last meeting, I came across a lecture that Dr. Sonu Shamdasani had delivered at the Library of Congress in 2010 at the occasion of the opening of the Red Book exhibit there at the Library of Congress. I had not heard the lecture, and I did not even know the title. Well, turned it on to listen. It was on hell. And it's one hell of a lecture. I listened to it several times, and I'll put a link on the webpage with this lecture, because I think you should listen to it too. And then a couple weeks after our last meeting, I after that lecture, hearing that lecture, I went to Geneva and had a chance to talk to Dr. Sonu Shamdasani at length at a seminar sponsored by the Philemon Foundation at the Bodmer Library in Geneva. And I got to hear a bit more about his experience working with and translating, editing the Red Book for publication. It was hell. The man went through hell. It was a remarkable journey, labor, there and back again. He amusingly expressed the situation in a lecture, describing himself as a recent denizen of hell, nailed and chained to this red book for what seemed fast approaching an eternity, and closer times to turning into a shade myself. Unquote. Those words only brush the surface of what this man went through a decade alone, contractually obligated not to talk to anyone about what he was doing with the Red Book. Alone for over a decade with the Red Book. Then at the beginning of Easter week, last week, a friend shared with me a difficult dream, which I immediately felt was a journey to hell. The dream pulled me into it, into hell, in the way a dream experience can become a shared fact, a shared experience. On the evening of Good Friday, I spent some time reflecting on the mystery play of Holy Week. As some of you may know, the liturgical ceremonies of Holy Week last for several days, culminating in Easter Sunday. And an image that I have met many times before on Good Friday came to me this year with terrible intensity. Christ is crucified and goes to hell. That is the myth. That is the story that has inseminated 2,000 years of Western culture. Before the glorious resurrection, Christ goes to hell. It's called the harrowing of hell. Well, later, much later that Friday night, I finally opened up Liber Novus to start beginning this lecture. And I really was not entirely certain where it was going to go or what had to be said. So I opened up the big book. And the first thing my eyes fell upon that night, Good Friday, was this following passage. It's in Liber Secundus, and it's right at the end of the material I talked with you about in our last session. And I quote Carl Jung from Liber Secundus of Liber Novus. Amen. It is finished. What was unreal is real. What was real is unreal. However, I may not. I do not want to. I cannot. Oh, human wretchedness. Oh, unwillingness in us. Oh, doubt and despair. This is really Good Friday, upon which the Lord died and descended into hell and completed the mysteries. This is the Good Friday when we complete the Christ in us and we descend to hell ourselves. This is the Good Friday on which we moan and cry to will the completion of Christ, for after his completion we go to hell. Christ was so powerful that his realm covered all the world, and only hell lay outside of it. Who succeeded in crossing the borders of this realm with good rounds, pure conscience, and obeying the law of love? Who among the living is Christ and journeys to hell in living flesh? Who is it that expands the realm of Christ with hell? Who is it that is full of drunkenness while sober? Who is it that descended from being one into being two? Who is it that tore apart his own heart to unite what had been separated? I am he, the nameless one, who does not know himself, and whose name is concealed even from himself. I have no name, since I have not yet existed, but have only just become. To myself I am an Anabaptist and a stranger. I, who I am not it, but I, who I will be. Who will be I before me and after me, am it. In that I abase myself, I elevate myself as another. In that I accept myself, I divide myself into two. And in that I unite myself with myself. I became the smaller part of myself. I am this in my consciousness. And then, a paragraph later, he says, I have been baptized with impure water for rebirth. A flame from the fire of hell awaited me above the baptismal basin. End of quote. To this, reflect on the commentary Jung gave and that I read earlier from the beginning of Liber Primus, the first part of Liber Novus. Words that on first encounter in the early sections of Liber Novus seem totally mad. Totally over the top, perhaps totally incomprehensible. I quote, therefore, after his death, Christ had to journey to hell. Otherwise, the ascent to heaven would have become impossible for him. Christ first had to become his Antichrist, his underworldly brother. No one knows what happened during the 3 days Christ was in hell. I have experienced it. End of quote. Well, that pretty well finished off Good Friday for me. And I closed the book and crawled to bed. But I knew what I had to talk about tonight. Hell is our subject. And in citation, here I must state that some of my comments tonight will reflect Dr. Shamdasani's lecture given at the Library of Congress in 2010. And that lecture is available on the internet, and I'll footnote it on my webpage for you if you wish to go listen to it. That lecture he gave narrative to footnotes he had already presented, actually, in Liber Novus. And if you read closely, you will find that there is an amazing narrative, several narratives, there in the footnotes that Dr. Shamdasani added in his editorial apparatus to Liber Novus. And of course, it's pretty hard to talk about Jung's Red Book without citing Dr. Shyam Dasani. There are a wealth of insights, a wealth of gems waiting exploration in the things he's already done. Hell. Do any of you believe in hell?
What do you mean, a state of mind or a place?
Good question. I suspect that as a physical place, most of you don't believe in hell.
I think that one goes to hell at certain times of their life in their own society.
Yes.
When terrible things happen.
Yes. Yes. You know that the image that you see, and you're immediately jumping right to the heart of the issue. You know, the image of a place, of a physical place, lakes of fire and brimstone and devils, lots of devils, multitudes of devils, all apparently contrived by a good God who had to add them in to have a complete and good creation, right? Multitudes of devils who were employed in ripping out tongues and eyeballs and hearts and genitals. Over and over. Forever and ever. World without end. Now, hell seems such an unenlightened place. Even to many Christian theologians across the ages. Hell as a place. And I don't suspect many of you believe in it. But I don't really care because beliefs are superfluous. There is a more relevant question, and this comes to that comment. A more immediate question of experience. Have you been to hell? Do you know hell? Or have you witnessed a person who herself has been lost in the blinding mists blowing from hell? I suspect so. And where is that hell? Is it in the underworld? Or is it under our human skin? Yeah, in the Oxford English Dictionary, hell is given first definition, among many, first as a place. It is the word used in English to translate the Hebrew word Sheol, found in the Old Testament, and it is the word used in the Greek New Testament, or word used to translate the Greek New Testament words, Hades, Tartarus, which of course are of Greek pagan origin, words that refer to the grave, the dead, and to another word, Gehenna. And Gehenna was apparently a pit of suffering. Mythologically, it was a pit outside of the city of Jerusalem where children were sacrificed to the god Baal. However, in the English language, dating back to Chaucer, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, hell has also been understood not just as a mythic or as a real metaphysical geographical place, but, and I quote, a state of wickedness, suffering, or misery. Not a physical place, but a state. And of course, that's immediately where you took it. A state of wickedness, suffering, and misery. We might call this state an existential perception, an existential situation. We do not have to go anywhere to arrive at its gates. There is a living hell within us. And living hell is not a concept, and it's not a belief. It's a realized existential fact. The stench of hell can well up over us as the memory of our lives, relentlessly relived. Our actions, our failings, our compulsions, our addictions, our family tragedies of fractured relationships and rejections, our wickedness, our wretchedness. It can be the recurring image of terrible, horrendous traumas, traumas of life lived. And that hell can seem our state of residence. But in fact, that is just the miasma blowing from the edges of the pit of hell. Hell goes deeper. In this signal myth sown in Western culture 2 millennia ago, Christ died on a cross and then he harrowed hell. Harrowed. The verb means to break the earth or to plow, till and seed. It also means to lacerate, cut, or even castrate. So goes the story. Christ harrowed hell. But how often do mortals confront hell, the pit of hell? How often do they cross the river Styx and face the terrible gate and meet the words that Dante read there? Abandon all hope, you who enter here. How many mortals harrow hell, their hell? And is the harrowing of hell a personal redemptive act? A task that demands our participation? Must we go to hell? Is this a myth that is true? In prior lectures, I pointed out that the word Christ and Christian and God appear copiously on the pages of Liber Novus. I now finally counted up and read again all the passages surrounding each of the occurrences of the word hell in Liber Novus. That's how I spent my Easter weekend. Appropriate. That was when Christ was harrowing hell. Yep. And I can tell you that the word is found on about a quarter of all the pages of Liber Novus. And repeatedly on most of the pages of Liber Secundus, that second central book of Liber Novus. So, add it to the top of your keyword list. Your index of Liber Novus. Soul, God, Christ, hell. At the very beginning of Liber Novus, the theme of hell appears. Jung titled an early section of Liber Primus, that first section that we talked about in our very earliest lectures, Descent into Hell in the Future. This section records and comments events that happened to Jung on the nights following December 12th of 1913. And again, this is just a month after this whole journey began. It began on 12th November 1913. So Jung had this dialogue, which I'll read, with his soul at the threshold of his descent. around December 16th. And I quote, "But on the fourth night I cried, 'To journey to hell means to become hell one's self. It is all frightfully muddled and interwoven. I have evidently taken on a completely monstrous form in which I can no longer recognize myself. It seems to me that I have become a monstrous animal form for which I have exchanged my humanity. This way is surrounded by hellish magic. Invisible nooses have been thrown over me and ensnare me.' But the spirit of the depths approached me and said, 'Climb down into your depths. Sink.' But I was indignant and said to him, 'How can I sink? I am unable to do this myself.' Then the spirit spoke words to me that appeared ridiculous. And he said, 'Sit yourself down. Be calm.' But I cried out indignantly, 'How frightful it sounds, like nonsense. Do you also demand this of me? The blood boils in me, and I would strangle you if I could seize you. You weave the thickest darkness, and I am like a madman caught in your net. But I yearn. Teach me.' But my soul spoke to me and said, 'My path is light.' Yet I indignantly answered, 'Do you call light what we men call the worst darkness? Do you call day night?' To this my soul spoke a word that roused my anger. 'My light is not of this world.' I cried, 'I know of no other world.'" End of quote. I know of no other world. Jung was about to discover another world in the depths of imagination. The Red Book is about a journey to hell. Or perhaps a marriage of heaven and hell. In numerous notes to Jung's Liber Novus text, Dr. Shamdasani calls attention to this theme and how it echoes across the imaginative traditions of Western culture. Of course, there is that story of Christ. And throughout Liber Novus, Jung confronts the imitation of Christ. But Sono frequently adds notes, if you watch, at various places in this text, to others who met this journey to hell, this fact of hell. Meister Eckhart, Dante, Milton, William Blake, Friedrich Nietzsche are prominent among them. In his lecture at the Library of Congress, coincident with the Red Book exhibit, which opened on 19 June 2010, Sono pulled this notational material into a narrative, into that talk I mentioned. There he suggests, and I fully agree, an imaginative tradition of hell exists across Western history. It's evidenced in our literature. And we witness a progressive struggle, an evolution of human imagination and visionary encounters with hell. Jung stands in that tradition of vision, a trajectory of vision and consciousness. Across the ages, the visionary or imaginative tradition has met a vision of hell. Dante's descent into the Inferno in his Commedia is the key text at the birth of our own vernacular age, an age begun in the 13th century, at first removed from the degenerating Latin classical forms that had dominated the first millennium of our own now passing age, the age of Pisces, the aeon of the fish. But how does one interpret this vernacular poem of Dante, written between 1308 and his death in 1321? Well, Dante gave part of the answer himself. In his famous letter on the poem, which he addressed to the Con Grande de la Scala, in that letter, Dante defined four forms of hermeneutics that might be applied even to his poem. Hermeneutics, the art of Hermes, the art of interpretation. Four forms of hermeneutics, four fashions in which his work might be read. The first categorical form is literal. Reading the poem literally, concretely, as a statement on a history of events. But Dante was traveling in a realm beyond the literal, and his poem demanded a different hermeneutics, a different method, art of interpretation. In his letter to Con Grande, Dante describes, in contrast to the literal mode of reading, three other approaches to the hermeneutic art, the art of interpretation. These are the allegoric, the moral, and the anagogic. How we might interpret Dante's poem in a literal, or allegorical, or moral fashion, well, that's evident enough. We have seven or more centuries of such interpretive efforts in our libraries. They're easy to find. But what is this fourth form, the magic fourth form of the hermeneutic art that Dante mentioned? It's called anagogy. And it's a word that I don't think many people are familiar with. It is a spiritual or a visionary path to interpretation. Not literal, not ethical, moral, not allegorical. It was mentioned, though never quite explained, in early medieval discussions of the hermeneutic art, dating at least to Hugo St. Victor around the year 1100. The Greek word anagoge means to lift up, or elevate. The interpretive art, hermeneutics, in anagogical mode, literally cleaves the horizontal axis of literal, moral, allegorical methods of understanding a text with a vertical axis. It reads the mystical meaning, the visionary fact formed and veiled with words. The visionary fact was considered as a fact of human experience. Anagogical interpretation demanded a return to the vision that was veiled while conveyed by text. To understand, one had to understand vision. Now, Jung read Dante in this anagogical fashion. In Jung's understanding, Dante was not reworking orthodox theology of St. Thomas Aquinas into his poem. And that is an historical interpretation that you'll find repeated. It's been often suggested in commentaries. Dante was bringing form, verbal, poetic form, to a vision. The imaginative, visionary fact of his own experience. That's how Jung read visionary literature. You just have to understand this about Jung. For Jung, vision, imagination, and the psyche were realities. A second world of reality accessible to human consciousness. Dante's poem was a hermeneutics of vision. An interpretive act born from vision. Visionary experience. Imaginative experience. Now there's evidence that Jung was actually reading Dante during his journey into hell, during his descent. In fact, he transcribes a couple of verses, key verses, from Dante into his black book journal during this period. So, when one is personally visiting hell, at the same time he is encountering Dante's text, the anagogical mode of hermeneutics becomes fully accessible to understanding. This was true of Jung at that point. Is that making sense? So Jung's in the midst of having this vision of hell. So when he reads Dante, and he's trying to write it down, these experiences, you know, the fishhook in the eye of ultimate evil, eating the liver, really circling down into the depths of the pit.
Well, it certainly seemed that way to me. And in fact, I thought the part I read this lecture was more like the visit to purgatory.
Yes.
As
yes.
To
yes, the layers.
Am I off of it?
No. You see, he circles. I mean, look, in the Red Book text, there are moments of profound light. I ended a couple of sessions ago on this, the incantations before the egg of Iztapar. I mean, immense light and darkness. It isn't all just darkness. But we'll talk about how one might discriminate light and darkness. Or if such a discrimination is a primary or a secondary issue. But you know, absent an encounter with vision, a primary, a personal, some impersonal type of encounter with vision, it's very difficult for a person to understand the hermeneutics of vision. If you have no experience of vision, how can you move into the realm of understanding an interpretive act of poetry, of text, to be centered by a visionary fact, if the fact is a non-reality, a non-existent, an unknown? Ethics we know, allegory we know, literal history, well, we think we know. Readers of Liber Novus face this precise problem. So I'll move on quickly to Emanuel Swedenborg. Emanuel Swedenborg, or Swedenborg, the 18th century scientist and Christian mystic. In April of 1745, at the age of about 57, Swedenborg was dining in a London tavern. At the end of his meal, his vision seemed to darken, and he noted a person sitting across in the corner of the room who said to him, "Don't eat so much." This really frightened him. And he went home that night, the same man appeared to him in a dream and announced that he was the Lord. Under his guidance, Swedenborg would travel through heaven and hell and talk with demons and angels. And so Swedenborg did over the next several years. Like Jung, Swedenborg was told to record what he had seen and heard. Swedenborg was thus to disclose the hidden meaning of the scriptures. As Dr. Shyam Dasani noted in his Library of Congress lecture, and I quote, in Swedenborg's work, Heaven and Hell, heaven and hell were presented as strictly dichotomous. All things in accord with divine order corresponded to heaven, and all contrary things to hell. The main thesis of Swedenborg's work is encapsulated in this statement: heaven and hell are from the human race. Heaven and hell are from the human race. End quote. Now note those words. For Swedenborg, heaven and hell were dichotomous, contraries in opposition. But both were from the human race. Humanity was the source. And Sonu then continued, and I quote, in a similar manner to Dante, Swedenborg not only presents a vision of hell, but also a hermeneutics, a spiritual hermeneutics. The Bible had two levels of meaning, a physical, literal level and an inner spiritual one. These were linked by the doctrine of correspondence. End quote. So that's only a snippet about Swedenborg. Eugene Taylor has written a great deal about Jung and Swedenborg and Swedenborg's influence on Jung, and I refer you there if you wish to read more. But Jung did study Swedenborg's writings when he was in university. In fact, I think it was Eugene Taylor, or maybe it was Sonu, went to the Basel library and got the checkout slips and found that over a series of months, Jung had checked out all of Swedenborg's books from the Basel library and read them while in university when he was about age 22 or 23. I think the book slip said 1898, if I remember correctly, but I may not remember that one correctly. This 23-year-old man was interested. Why? The fellow had already had a few visions himself. He was rather interested in what people had to say about visionary experience, including Emanuel Swedenborg. Let me jump back from Jung, back 100 years. Swedenborg and his visions were also important to another young visionary, William Blake, the great English poet, artist, and prophet. And here I'm going to quote again from Dr. Shyam Dasani's lecture. I quote, from his youth, Blake had visions of angels and historical figures whom he conversed with. And for a time, indeed, he joined the Swedenborgian church in London, where it was established. Blake became critical of the institutionalization of Swedenborgianism and began to take a more critical view of Swedenborg. Around 1790, he published his work, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. In The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, Blake articulated his critique of Swedenborg. Indeed, the very title, Marriage of Heaven and Hell, encapsulated his sense that these were not two radically dichotomous and distinct locations. What Swedenborg failed to see, Blake noted in his annotations to Swedenborg, was that heaven and hell are born together. not two radically dichotomous and distinct locations. That was what Blake critiqued in Swedenborg. Not two radically dichotomous locations. In Blake's concept, heaven and hell were born together in our discrimination of an inner, perhaps, visionary reality. They traveled as twins.
Was there any commonality between Jung, Blake, and others that perhaps in their youth they became susceptible to the concept of vision?
I'll just step back and say, I don't know. And I don't think anyone can know. Because none of us has the clinical history of a child from birth in womb, trauma of birth, childhood events, and even each of us sitting here. Well, we carry those things with us. How many of them can call them to memory and identify causality? Some things I simply think are just nature.
Unknowable.
Unknowable. And nature, our souls, the fact of who we are is utter mystery. Most of us are a mystery to ourselves all of our lives. It's just how it is. So let me step back then. So note here, Blake took the fact of Swedenborg's visions quite seriously, since he too had seen visions beginning in childhood, as Victor just noted. Nonetheless, Blake thought Swedenborg had both seen something and failed to see something. In Blake's experience, heaven and hell are born together. They are not dichotomous and distinct locations. So Sona continues. Blake articulated a notion of dynamic oppositions. What is basic is a series of contraries: attraction and repulsion, reason and energy, love and hate. And these oppositions were necessary for life. What religions called good and evil were secondary terms, derivatives which sprang from these basic contraries. They were not primary. The series of contraries, including the contraries of heaven and hell, were not primary, according to Blake. So what then was primary? I give here my own answer. Human perception, human vision, human consciousness. The primary fact was the differentiation brought to the visionary world by human consciousness in direct encounter with the imaginal, realm. And this is very much the exegesis that Jung gives in the Seven Sermons to the Dead, the summary revelation of Liber Novus. In the Seven Sermons, you will find just such a litany of secondary oppositions discriminated by human consciousness from the undifferentiated pleroma of potential. They are secondary constructs, the product of a primary and discriminating fact. What's the primary fact? You. You're the primary fact. Your discriminating inclinations are abraxas, to use Jung's term from the Seven Sermons, abraxas in this world. And note, it's fairly certain that Jung did not get any of his concepts from Blake. This was Jung's own perception, his own summary of his own experiences with his own vision. So, we've been dealing for months with Jung's visions, what he called his revelation. Repeatedly, I've asked you to consider what Jung was doing in Liber Novus. What was he experiencing? And I'll try to give some of my own answers again a bit later, not too much later. But first, I must share with you a few postcards. They arrived in my mailbox over this week. I've forwarded them to you. So open your mailbox, or female box. you have mail. Mail from hell. The pit of suffering, the land of the dead. And if you happen to go there, these picture postcards might help orient you to the countryside. Postcards from Hell by C.G. Jung. Liber Primus, Folio 5. And I quote, "He who journeys to hell also becomes hell. Therefore do not forget from whence you come. The depths are stronger than us, so do not be heroes. Be clever and drop the heroics, since nothing is more dangerous than to play the hero. The depths want to keep you. They have not returned very many up to now, and therefore men fled from the depths and attacked them." Quote, "Take pains to waken the dead. Dig deep mines and throw in sacrificial gifts so that they reach the dead. Reflect in good heart upon evil. This is the way to ascent. But before the ascent, everything is night and hell." Quote, "What do you think of the essence of hell? Hell is when the depths come to you with all that you no longer are and are not yet capable of. Hell is when you can no longer attain what you could attain. Hell is when you must think and feel and do everything that you know you do not want. Hell is when you know that your having to is also wanting to, and that you yourself are responsible for it. Hell is when you know everything serious that you have planned with yourself is also laughable. That everything fine is also brutal. That everything good is also bad. That everything high is also low. And that everything pleasant is also shameful." Liber Segundus, Folio 9, quote, "Do not place your disgust between you here and now and your beyond. The way to your beyond leads through hell. In fact, through your own particular hell, whose bottom consists of knee-deep rubble, whose air is the spent breath of millions, whose fires are dwarf-like passions, and whose devils are chimerical signboards." Everything odious and disgusting is your own particular hell. How can it be otherwise? Your hell is made up of all the things that you always ejected from your sanctuary with a curse and a kick of the foot. When you step into your own hell, never think that you come like one suffering in beauty or as a proud pariah, but you come like a stupid and curious fool and gaze in wonder at the scraps that have fallen from your table. Liber Segundus, Folio 10, quote, "If you go through hell, you should not forget to give due attention to whatever crosses your path. Quietly look into everything that excites your contempt or rage. Thereby you accomplish the miracle that I experienced. You give soul to the soulless, and thereby it can come to something out of horrible nothingness. you will redeem your other into life. You cannot at the same time be on the mountain and in the valley, but your way leads you from the mountain to the valley, and from valley to mountain. Much begins amusingly and leads into the dark. Hell has levels. Liber Segundus, folio 74, quote, "My God rose in the eastern sky, brighter than the heavenly host, and brought about a new day for all the peoples. This is why I want to go to hell. Would a mother not want to give up her life for her child? How much easier would it be to give up my life? If only my God could overcome the torment of the last hour of the night and victoriously break through the red mist of the morning. He who does not want evil will have no chance to save his soul from hell. So long as he remains in the light of the upper world, he will become a shadow of himself. But his soul will languish in the dungeons of the diamonds. This will act as a counterbalance that will forever constrain him. The higher circles of the inner world will remain unattainable for him. He remains where he was. Indeed, he falls back." End quote. And thus we circle back to Jung's words recorded near the beginning of his tale. And perhaps now we can begin to understand the cryptic comments in that first strange postcard from hell. After his death, Christ had to journey to hell. Otherwise, the ascent to heaven would have become impossible for him. Christ first had to become his Antichrist, his underworldly brother. Christ first had to become his Antichrist, his underworldly brother. No one knows what happened during the 3 days Christ was in hell. I have experienced it. End quote. Okay, what the hell does this have to do with Jungian psychology? That's a rhetorical question. My first answer is entirely tangential. Please understand, there is no Jungian psychology. There are now a magnitude of psychologies that claim lineage from Jung, often with thin threads of legitimacy and a bit too much or far too little real snake oil. But who is the Pope with authority to declare orthodoxy and heresy within the Holy Order of Jung? As Jung said, "Thank God I am Jung and not a Jungian." You are the soul, and I do mean soul, agent, who can decide what Jung's psychology is or is not. And the place to start your deciphering on that subject is Liber Novus, the Numinous Beginnings, which contained everything. So I'll refrain from further diatribe about Jungian psychologies. And now answer rhetorically my own rhetorical question. What the hell does this have to do with Jungian psychology? My fellow wayfarers, this is Jung's psychology. His psychology is an expression of his empirical observation. Empirical observation of the psyche. For Jung, the psyche was real, and hell and heaven were realities in that reality. If you have questions about his travels, please again read some of those postcards. Put them on the fridge. We have received in the name of C.G. Jung a number of concepts. Archetype, anima, collective unconscious, persona, shadow, to name a few names. But I've noted that in Jungian circles, in Jungian discussions, we all too often use these words and names like apotropaic charms. They become magical names and amulets needed to ward off evil, to build walls around experience of the psyche, and to categorize it and to box it up. Experiences, visions can be intense. They can be shattering. Jung knew it. Vision can be real. But there comes a time in some lives when one must take the elevator down to hell. Or cross the river that stinks. Or break through the wall in the house one knows and find behind the wall that secret coven of witches and the path that leads down to their dark master. Those are real dream images. Sometimes we do pass through a party of Hell's Angels with their motorbikes. On a path that leads down, down, difficultly down until we reach the pit of hell where something awaits us. It is a terror, it is a horror. And my friends, it is us, a part of us. Hell is in us. So look, as therapists, I know. You meet people lost in chaos at the outskirts of hell. They don't want to go further in. They want to get the hell out. They want salvation. They want a path out. And often one's duty is to give aid, to offer some life preserver that they can cling to and hold their heads above the fiery lake. But sometimes for some people, and who those people are and how they are selected among the generations of men, I do not know. How they are selected among the generations of women, I know even less. But it happens. Sometimes people must go on this journey. Yes, we do want the bright light. We want to ascend to heaven. We want to behold the flowers at the top of the tree of life. We want to experience the jewel in the heart of the lotus. But to reach the top of that mystical tree, enlightenment, we also must know its roots. Those roots descend into darkness. And if we deny it, refuse to face it, refuse to meet it. That fact, denied, will haunt us. It will draw us back to ground. To read again what Jung said, he who does not want evil, he who does not want evil, will have no chance to save his soul from hell. So long as he remains in the light of the upper world, he will become a shadow of himself. But his soul will languish in the dungeons of the diamonds. This will act as a counterbalance that will forever constrain him. The higher circles of the inner world will remain unattainable for him. He remains where he was. Indeed, he falls back. End quote. He who does not want evil will have no chance to save his soul from hell. Conceptually, or terminologically, wrapping up the facts of this inner darkness as an experience of shadow can depotentiate the objective reality. You can't sugarcoat hell. Conceptually, verbally, dogmatically, psychologically. And I've heard people tell a dream, sense the depths it probed, and retreat back from it with a declaration of recognition. Oh, that is my shadow. It's just a word, but a good Jungian word. And the interpretation is then thought complete. By categorizing, it's completed. The hermeneutics of vision is accomplished, done. The experience is devolved, pulled back into a concept, into a box. And concepts are much, much easier to face than the demons of hell. I assure you of that, based on experience. Experience, at least, with concepts. I won't talk about the demons. Look, at the gateway of hell, Dr. Carl Gustav Jung abandoned his concepts, his theories, and his dogmas. He met what awaited him directly. He was forced to meet a dark brother. And he could not meet the light of a glorious Lord within without confronting the darkness of the Antichrist and his hell. These two discriminations of nature were born together. And both need our unifying consciousness. In fact, it may be our unifying consciousness, which is the redemptive act in this cosmos. At the end of his lecture at the Library of Congress, Dr. Shyam Dasani commented on Jung's critique of Emanuel Swedenborg. It was just this issue of retreating into conceptualizations that Jung saw as Swedenborg's failing. Swedenborg protected himself from the fire of his vision by boxing the imaginal reality in intellectually contrived concepts. And this is what you read in Swedenborg. This is why I find him very irritating to try to plow through. Swedenborg saw visions. They were very real experiences. And he translated them immediately, conceptually. The conceptual framework then took on a life of its own and multiplied, generated with itself. So, Shyam Dasani here comments, and I will quote, "But Jung is not merely being critical of Swedenborg but indicating for many men, concept was all they would have to hold on to be able to withstand the experiences in question. Concepts were all they would have to be able to hold on to withstand the experiences in question. What experiences? Well, visionary experiences, imaginative experiences that came as realities. Okay? And I continue in quote. Now, this raises the question whether Jung's later conceptual system, which in some of his followers has not lacked for doctrinaireness, forms such a safety net or guardrail, vital for some, no doubt, but protection which may block access to the very experiences in question. Now this is precisely the question that needs to be raised and fully confronted about psychology, Jungian psychology, conceptual terminological psychology. Jung's later conceptual system, the words we identify as Jungian psychology, do form a safety net, a guardrail. And yes, guardrails to grasp may be necessary for some individuals, but they are also a protection that may block access to the very experiences at the center of Jung's psychology. And the experience of hell is one such fact. Dr. Shyamdasani, in conclusion, at his Library Congress talk, gave these words in summary. And look, I was amazed to hear them spoken. Utterly amazed. I had intuited them in his work, but I had not seen them written or spoken. And this is the core of my own knowledge of Carl Gustav Jung, dating back to a night in 1987. And I quote, "If, as Jung claimed, Dante and Blake clothed visionary experience in mythological form, could we not pose the question, did Jung, in turn, attempt to clothe visionary experience in conceptual psychological forms? If so, the power and significance of his work does not reside in his concepts, which are familiar to us, but in the visionary experience, which was at the back of them." End quote. Yes, Dr. Sonu Shyamdasani. Yes, thank you. Thank you for saying that. The power and significance of Jung's work does not reside in his concepts. So familiar to us, and so often parroted as Jungian psychology, but instead resides in the visionary experience from which those concepts took first formation. While the primary stakeholders in the brand name of Jung have apparently to date been Jungian analysts, their societies have proven contentious and frequently and recently quite schismatic, as Jung himself foresaw to be inevitable, and narrowly focused on clinical psychotherapeutics, increasingly disengaged from Jung and from Jung's defining experience and hermeneutics. Jung cannot and must not be boxed and labeled and sold as a therapeutic potion to be administered only by certified Jungian analysts. We simply need to begin again. We need to ask who this man was. Without referencing previous and often ill-informed opinion. And we need to entirely reconsider his place in history past and in the history that will be written by the coming aeon. Only now, with Liber Novus in hand, can we begin to fathom the thrust of C.G. Jung's life work. In another generation, only a precious fraction of the plethora of stuff written about Jung prior to publication of Liber Novus will be read by anybody. Much of it will seem little more than a peculiar historical sideshow to the vital spirit of this great man's work. Jung located himself within a tradition that reaches across an aeon, 2,000 years of history. He cannot be confined in the box of early 20th century psychology. For the last 15 years or more, I've, in my own small way, addressing a very, very small audience, been trying to call attention to this fact. Jung stood within a tradition. I have called it the tradition of vision. A tradition defined by its hermeneutics of vision. And recently I was pleased to hear Dr. Sonu Shamdasani use those same words. Jung and his psychology have nothing to do with Freud. Jung simply was not rooted in that night soil. Jung's roots went far deeper into the rich perennial experience of human imagination and vision and imagination. To understand Jung, we have to recognize his tradition, a real tradition, a human tradition of a human experience of vision. The vision tradition had its own hermeneutics. It is a tradition both defined by and conveyed by a hermeneutics of vision. As Jung repeatedly affirmed, the tradition reaches back to the gnosis of early Christianity. Jung pointed often to evidence of the perpetuation of the tradition, a tradition which is actually sustained across the millennia in singular events of human experience. Singular events of imaginative experience. Singular events of visionary experience. This was the vital elixir of Hermeticism and alchemy and Gnosticism, as Jung documented in his alchemical works. In the imaginative literary tradition of Dante and Swedenborg and Blake, he found evidence of the core visionary experience that centered this tradition. As he found it in Goethe and Nietzsche, other figures often cited by Jung, and Meister Eckhart, the great Christian mystic, the great voice of medieval Christian vision, stood in his company. Jung saw witness of the experience, the imaginative vision in Paracelsus, and also in the Jewish Kabbalists, a principal and signal example being the great Ari, Isaac Luria. All these were wayfarers who crossed the fiery threshold of outer reality and beheld the terror and the splendor of an infinite inner reality. To their visions they brought interpretive arts, a hermeneutics of vision. Their legacy and Jung's legacy stand together as a witness to the most precious of all facts, the fact of the human soul, a fact unbounded by cosmos or creation. Thank you.